Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
Once in a generation, a mind comes along, a mind that understands more than the average person and is more than willing to share his knowledge. From trees to food plots to fertilizer, Dudley Phelps knows so much that he has forgotten more than he remembers. And now he gives you the chance to ask the burning questions in your mind. It's time for Ask Dudley.
Hey, this episode is brought to you by none other than Native Nurseries.
You can check it out, nativenurseries.com.
Yep, I work there.
All right, so they brought us back for episode 3 of Ask Dudley. They're letting us keep doing this, Dud. What do you think?
I'm glad. I mean, I've been unloading tree tubes off a truck for the last hour and a half, so this is a lot
nicer.
Cooler in here.
That's right. We're like in hoodies right now. We're kind of cold in the office, so. Man, we have been so busy these last several weeks that we've been trying to get this on like a bi-weekly schedule. We haven't been able to do that, but I think that people will forgive you and me for that.
Yeah, we just need to keep rolling with it.
All right, Dudley, what is this episode about?
It's a lot of wildflower, successional, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Why do wildflowers matter?
Man, they just do. And we're learning more and more we're becoming to be more and more knowledgeable about how important they are. And, you know, or the population in general is becoming to understand more about how important those kinds of ecosystems are.
Yeah.
The early successional habitat with grasses, wildflowers.
Is that more specifically related to, you hear a lot of people talking about like the bee crisis and, you know, bee die off, and is it important for pollinators or what are we talking?
I think it's important for everything. I mean, it's a piece of the puzzle, and we have basically erased it off the planet for the most part. And you know, everything is a yard or an ag field or a cow pasture or a roadside that gets sprayed now, and there's not a whole lot of these. Most of it's upland, you know, especially around here, but it's just missing.
Are you encouraged by the kind of resurgence that you've seen in the last, really feels like in the last 5 years has been really hot and heavy on natives and on wildflowers more so? I know y'all have cared about it. We have cared about it at Mossy Oak for a long time, but has it been encouraging to see the general population?
Well, I mean, it got me too. I mean, I consider myself an expert on trees, and I love all things outside, you know, stuff that grows, soil,
yeah,
everything. But, you know, like you said, in the last 4 or 5 years, I've realized how important it is. It finally resonated in my mind.
Okay.
And I hope more and more people get that.
Yeah. So I guess the first question that I kind of want to hit on, this is from Hunter Green. He asked, what's the importance of pollinators and things of that nature, bugs and all that cool stuff?
Right. Good question. And I see a lot of him on social media trying to do cool stuff at his place.
Yeah, and learn more. It's awesome.
Well, it's really about what we were just talking about. We've always, here in the hunting industry, we've always been so deer centric. I feel like, you know, if you want to kill big bucks and, you know, all of that has been going around for the last 30 years, but now a lot of us are interested in the big picture. Yes, we like big bucks, but we also like sitting on the deer stand and watching some chickadees flutter around in front of us. You know, we like watching that hawk swooping around over those tall grasses while we're sitting in our deer stand and things like that. And we're realizing more and more how much it all goes together, works together. And now that we, in a lot of the U.S., we're noticing our turkey numbers are diminishing. I think that's helped us realize a lot, you know, a lot how early successional habitat is, how important it is. And let's face it, go into a mowed yard and kick your feet around and walk for 20 or 30 yards and tell me how many insects you jump up out of that, and then go through a wildflower planting you've established or you've managed for and made that ecosystem come back. Walk through that and kick your legs around and tell me how many bugs you see, and you'll see a ton of them.
Yeah, when we were doing the thing about should you mow, should you not mow, you were showing that to me out there where we walked through a section that had been mowed, and then we walked through a section that was still tall, up in tall grass, and it really was staggering to see how many different bugs and insects were in there versus the mowed part.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting stuff.
A lot of bird food, a lot of all kinds of food.
So yeah, Hunter's right. It is cool stuff. And we want to soak in as much as we can and do more of it, even if it's a small area in your yard or around your cabin.
Okay. So we'll keep rolling with them. We'll get right into it. So Will Dixon asks, the poor man's approach for fallow field, old pasture conversion.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. You know, for years it was all about establishing native warm season grasses. Everybody wanted to know how to get these thick, tall, you know, the switchgrass and stuff for deer cover. And in time, I think we've realized that, you know, the grasses are great. Our grasslands are, you know, why the soils in the Midwest are so productive for ag crops. But one thing we're realizing is how important that broadleaf component is, in addition to that tall grass.
So what are some of those broadleaf species that you're talking about for somebody who might not know?
The ragweeds, the goldenrods. And you know, we're talking about food. We're also talking about cover. We're also talking about, the broadleaf plants that the insects like. You know, there's certain insects that use certain species of plants to lay their eggs on and things like that. But yeah, we're talking about this old field habitat that, gosh, picture yourself sitting in a deer stand and all you can see is their head sticking out of it. If that, you want it to be like 2 or 3 year old thick out in the field. And, one easy way to do it is just to quit mowing it. And let it grow up. You could disc it a little bit, you know, disc portions of it. So you may have different plant communities come up in different areas. You might could spray clethodim on one side of the field to kill the grasses and have a bunch of broadleaves come up and do the opposite. You could spray a broadleaf herbicide like 2,4-D on the other side and get more grassy weeds. And that's without having to get a bunch of seed and do all of that. But it depends on your budget and it depends on what plant species are in the seed bank. If you may just let it grow and a bunch of, some kind of invasive like Sericea lespidiza pops up everywhere. So, there's no one way plan on making old field habitat, but yeah, you can let it grow up. You can burn it. The first thing I would want to do is make sure there's not a bunch of invasives coming up. So if you've got a bunch of ryegrass and fescue in there, you're going to have to spend a year getting rid of that.
Okay. And how would you get rid of that?
Well, you would want to spray some grass selective herbicides. Or in the case of fescue, you probably need to spray Roundup or Roundup mixed with arsenal.
Okay. I was talking to Austin Delano about this the other day. It's a very good idea to spray your grass selective herbicide prior to that grass going to seed.
Correct.
Because if you do it after that, then you just have to deal with it next year.
Right. So one thing you could do, just say you've got a big food plot you're wanting to convert. It's late winter. You hadn't done anything. Probably what I would do in that scenario, and he's asking on a budget. So
yeah.
When you talk about herbicides and things, you're spending money. But you got this real green stuff. Half of it is ryegrass or fescue. I would try to terminate those cool season plants in that field prior to the spring. And then let what comes up come up. Yeah. And if I've got fields at my farm that I've let fallow that I haven't treated that have Johnson grass and things like that, but there's also good stuff in there. So it really just depends on your budget, you know. Yeah. Either let it grow and combine it with a little bit of strip disking or something like that. If it's in your budget, definitely try to get rid of some non-natives and things that are in there. But yeah, short answer, let the stuff grow.
Okay. I mean, it seems that burning is a really good tool.
After it's, you know,
the poor man's method or anybody's method, but if you're not going to be running a tractor, you're not going to be running a disc.
Yeah, you could probably, if you've got a field that, just say you've got a 2-acre field that's a food plot, maybe you could put a ring around it, disc a ring around it so it kind of stays short and there's a lot of exposed soil. So you can burn when the time comes. So if it, you know, if it all comes up in something you don't want and you want to burn it, of course, if you burn some of this, there's so many different scenarios.
Yeah.
If you were to burn this like in the late summer, you're probably going to encourage a lot of cool season stuff to pop up that you don't want in there. So you just have to develop a good eye and understand what a lot, you know how to identify a lot of these species that are in the fields. And figure out how to get rid of the stuff you don't want and leave the stuff you do.
Yeah. And it really sounds like it's a multi-year process any way you slice it, because you have to deal with your warm season and your cool season and then stuff you missed the year before,
right,
or stuff that was in the seed bank. And so
a good way to get started, 101 beginner, just let it grow. And then you can start identifying what's in there. You know, so we've answered this question 5 times, but you see there's really no way to,
yeah,
one way to skin a cat in,
yep,
this scenario.
Yep. Because I mean, I have so many more questions. I'm like, when you talk about identifying, are you talking about like, are you like going to grid out your pasture and say, okay, I want to know what's in this part of the field? Are you just walking straight lines and with a notepad and paper and writing down everything you see? Is there an app you use to help you identify stuff? If I walk out there versus you, that's
right,
very different.
Well, you can take a picture of that stuff and then come home and try to ID it. You know, there's those ID apps. You can try to get close. You know, maybe ask an extension agent, you know, what are some of the non-native plants that come up in old fields in your area? Learn how to ID them from a book or from photos. So when you do go out there, maybe you'll know what they are.
Gotcha. Stevens Howard asks, what are the best wildflowers to plant in the Southeast with a no-till method? He says he doesn't have a tractor.
Okay. So another, like a poor man's no-till approach. And Stevens asked a lot of good questions, but, same way, you know, anywhere you've got good enough sunlight to grow some of these wildflowers, one thing that would, you know, there again, you know, you have to look at what you have to work with. There's, you know, you might have fescue in that field. You may have ryegrass. You may have brome. You may, yeah, have, you know, something. But one thing that has worked really well for me is to start like a fall food plot that's mostly cereal grains or, mm-hmm, all cereal grains. You know, you could do straight oats or straight wheat, which is a grass, and get that going in the fall. And then that next spring or, you know, maybe in February, you can overseed it with some wildflower seeds. We've got 2 good mixes at Native Nurseries. One is more like pretty flowers, pollinators, birds. Another one is tall, like cover, like old field habitat type stuff.
Gotcha.
But they all have blooms and whatnot. But you could fling either of those mixes or mix them together out in that field over the top of that wheat. And then once that wheat starts growing really fast in the early spring, you can spray over the top of it with clethodim, kill the wheat, and then your broadleaf wildflowers can pop up in it. We did that several times in some locations around town, just some empty lots and things that,
yeah,
the city board asked us to beautify, and it worked like a champ. We did it that way in Toxie's backyard to prep for a wedding. It was awesome. And that's all
awesome.
We did was we flung out a bunch of, you know, like we were growing a food plot, but it was just wheat or oats, and then spread our wildflower seeds and then terminated those grasses, you know, the wheat or oats the following spring.
Yeah. Okay. David Holly, aka the Wild Turkey Report, asks, best time of year to plant, and could you plant behind a fresh burn?
Absolutely. You can even plant before a burn.
What does that burning do?
Well, some seeds it can burn up. Some seeds it can scarify, like they need that heat. Again, another experiment out at Toxies, we flung a bunch of partridge pea seed out one time right before a burn, and it has a really hard seed coat. And man, we got a good stand of partridge pea behind that.
Really?
But if you were to fling something else out that, you know, maybe that seed can burn through. So, I would say probably do a little bit of both, but, most of the time, if you're trying to get something going, I'd probably burn first and throw the seed out, knowing that those hard coated seeds are going to come up the next year after they've been through some freeze and thaw.
Yeah. So for any of these wildflowers that we're planting, if say we planted them in June, would we expect to see those flowers come up and do anything that first year? Or is it it's an investment? I mean, it seems like it's almost like it's a year before you see them come back up.
A lot of folks plant native grasses and wildflowers in June. You just have to know that not all of those are going to sprout the first year.
Yeah.
Some of them are going to need to go through a winter.
Yeah. I mean, it's like your mailbox prairie.
Right.
You know, this is what, year three?
Something like that. Year three or four.
Yeah. And you were saying how this year it's really jamming. And the previous two, it took a little bit of time to really set up and for the seeds to develop and fall. And another question, best time of year to plant grass and flower plugs?
Okay. Best time of year to plant plugs? Really, just like planting trees. So typically in the north, it's too cold to plant in the dead of winter, and usually the ground is frozen. So that wouldn't be a good time up north for obvious reasons.
Be a little tough.
Unless you had a pickaxe or something. But even then would be bad. So in the north, you want to plant either in the fall or the spring. So typically what I tell folks up north is when the trees are starting to change color, that's a good time to start planting. And it may be a little bit dry that time of year, but also the plants you're growing they're signs, you know, their days are getting shorter, so they can handle the stresses of late summer, early fall a little better than you would think, but you still want to water them in on planting day really good. But fall's a great time to plant because they can root in before the cold hits and they'll have that much more root area before they have to go in the spring.
Yeah.
Whereas also you can plant in the spring up north after the ground is thawed out and there's a lot of rain and all that, but there's also a lot of competition. So there's pros and cons, but either or is great, or do a little bit of both up north.
Okay.
Oftentimes availability is better in the fall, especially from our stuff.
Okay.
Now in the south, you can pretty much plant any time of year, but you really wouldn't want to plant in the middle of July unless it was in your backyard and you were able to water all the time. So what I tell folks in the south is once the ground is wet for the winter, so the leaves have changed colors, they're dropping really heavily, you start getting a few winter pattern rains then, and the ground, you know, there's not a whole lot of plants drinking and it's not as hot either. So the moisture is not going to come out of the soil as quickly. So it generally stays wettish for the remainder of the winter. So you can plant all winter long in the south. So basically late fall, probably into late spring is the safe time to plant in the south.
Okay.
And it's the same with trees, grasses, or wildflower plugs.
Okay. So what about, are there particular varieties of wildflowers that tend to thrive in lower light situations?
Yeah, that was another question, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Somebody was asking about planting in low light around pine trees. Well, there are some species that you will find that do better in, you know, it still gets a little bit of sun. And keep in mind, pines, they have that dappled sunlight from the, you know, the needles. It's not like a big wide leaf, you know. And then if you are a wildlifer and you're managing your pines, we typically keep our pines thinned and keep them more open so there is enough sunlight to hit the ground so we can have some herbivory underneath the trees. So keep that in mind. If you're a wildlifer, you're going to have a little bit more sunlight under your pines. We like to, you know, thin back to a basal area of about 70. Whereas if you're just straight up timber, all you're wanting is the money, usually thin them to about a basal area of 85, which quickly goes back to where there's not enough sun. And that can get a little confusing if you don't know what basal area is. But typically, you know, but the lower the number, the further apart your pine trees are, more or less.
Yeah.
I think we mentioned the definition of that a podcast or two ago.
Yeah.
But
the basal area is the...
So if you were to cut a tree off at 4.5 feet above the ground, you have a circle cross section. And you were to turn that into a square footage per acre of all the trees in the stand, that would be your basal area. But so some of the species that come to mind that I see tromping around, like Joe Pye weeds, some of your wild geraniums, bergamots, like that, you know, that species of mint we have out in the mailbox prairie.
Yeah.
Bidens, those are all your tick seeds. You know, that little black seed that sticks to your pants and it has those two prongs.
Mm.
They've got a real pretty yellow flower, great bird food. Just about every kind of aster, you know, black-eyed Susans. Desmodium is a, that's that triangular shaped seed that sticks to you like Velcro.
Some people call that beggar's lice.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that is a legume, like a pea or a bean. It fixes nitrogen. Deer like to browse it. Quail, turkeys, you know, birds like the seeds. Rubus, which is all of our blackberries. They'll grow under a pine understory. One of my favorites, which is kind of an unsung hero of mine, is devil's walking stick. People used to think of that as a weed, but it's a, you know, it grows really tall. The stem is spiky, but, I've never seen so many bees and insects in my life on, you know, blooms of devil's walking stick.
Wow. What about wisteria? Sometimes I see that
well, there's a native wisteria and then there's a really invasive non-native one. And that's most of the times what you see. And it can get to the upper reaches of the canopy to get sun. It'll climb the trees and smother them.
Yeah. Okay. So, that's what I was going to ask you. I've seen it out and I think I've always been in the camp of, man, that's pretty.
Yeah.
But it's harming trees.
Yeah.
Don't plant wisteria.
That was probably somebody's house a long time ago and then they moved and the house fell apart, whatever. And then the wisteria took over.
Gotcha.
Pokeweed. There's all kinds of stuff, but the drive home point here is, if you're growing pine trees on your land and you have an inkling of recreational/wildlife attitude, you need to be thinning your trees a little bit more than you would if you were growing them just for timber.
Yeah.
And that will host all kinds of good stuff in the understory.
Awesome. So. Okay. Tristan Steen asks, how to promote native species during the growing season? I'm assuming he's asking, do you need to fertilize them? Do you need to weed around them? How should you handle this?
And there's, you know, from very broad to very specific, you know, you can be driving around in the growing season, which is now, you can be spraying and killing. I went to a buddy's place, about a week ago and they had this prairie site. It's real chalky soil. And it was nothing but cedar trees everywhere. And they had little 2 and 3 acre openings cleared of cedars. And it came back and just amazing stuff. But the only bad thing, about a fourth of it is coming up in Sericea lespidiza. So Tristan, if that's going on, you could be spot treating that Sericea.
What about if you were spraying?
Or you could be collecting seed. You could be preparing sites for next year to plant some plugs or to plant some seed. So one thing you can do, just say you've got a field that's being overtaken by Bermuda grass. You could be treating that Bermuda this summer and making a clean slate so you can get some some native stuff to pop up in there next year. That's one of the things about establishing natives is it's not really, typically, it's not like going to do a food plot where you just burn it down, disc it, and plant it.
Yeah.
We have introduced all of these bad plants that have taken over our landscape that oftentimes we have to get rid of first before we bring these natives back. So you can spend a lot of your, you know, not hunting season, which is, I think is what he's referring to.
Yeah.
Trying to get rid of some of the bad stuff and prepping to plant your good stuff.
What about if you were going to spray a grass selective herbicide, could you come back or could you tank mix something like Mean Green in with that? Or would you run the risk of over fertilizing other non-desirable?
Yeah. Yeah. You can definitely mix, fertilizers in with your herbicides. There's some specific ones that work better.
Yeah. Follow the label.
Yeah. Follow the label. So, that, you know, Mean Green would work. Some of these liquid foliar fertilizers work well for that.
Great. Okay.
What else could you be doing out there? But, you know, while you're doing that, you can be showing your neighbors what you're doing. So
there's your kind of like a discipleship kind of aspect. Of, yeah.
So your neighbor that's just snatching brim all summer and not doing any habitat work. Yeah. Show them some of your results.
All right. We just bought a house and, you know, have a couple acres and there's about a half an acre or so that I probably want to dedicate to some level of wildflowers or something. One, I'd like to kind of use it as a barrier to absorb a little bit of water that we're getting on some runoff.
Yeah.
But two, it's just an area of the yard that I don't imagine are using unless I put something there that would literally draw us towards it. So that we do something out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, so say I had, you know, houses set back off the road a little bit, had about a half acre in front of the house, and I wanted to use some of that. What would I do? It's in St. Augustine right now.
Right. In that situation, I'd probably just go to bare ground.
Yeah. Like mow it low? Or are you talking about
I would probably just go ahead and spray it. If you're just completely anti-spray. We probably need to get into that topic at some point.
Yeah.
You could even put a huge tarp down and maybe cover it with some mulch. Actually, I think it'd be cooler to put the mulch down and then put the tarp over it. So some of that's going to be working down into the soil.
Yeah.
But anyway, you just need to keep that sprayed or keep it treated to where there's nothing growing there. And I would go ahead and plant it this fall.
Okay.
I mean, you could wait as long as waiting until late spring to get it established.
Gotcha.
But
well, I mean, there's also too, I imagine a lot of people would like to do something like this with their drainages, like where it, they either have to mow it and they're tired of mowing it or they're tired of getting out there and weed eating it. Or something where it's just an area that otherwise is kind of unused.
Mm-hmm.
Are there particular varieties of wildflowers or warm season grasses or other things that are hardier to getting a little bit of water on them? The water will come up and go away.
Right.
But, you know, you could have anywhere to 5 to 6 inches of water on them for a second and then mm-hmm. it would dissipate.
Right.
But are there hardier varieties for drainages and things like that?
Somewhat. Yeah. And in that scenario, you can't really make it weed free because it's a slope and water's going through it. So,
yeah. So it's going to pull stuff right. constantly.
But you know, yard grasses have a really shallow root system, whereas natives have a really deep root system. So they actually help the water infiltrate into the soil and drain better instead of running off on the surface. So in that scenario, just say you've got yard grass like St. Augustine. I would probably just plug some wildflowers and native grasses in there. You could even stick some willow cuttings in there, things like that, that are going to root in quickly. I've got a buddy that works on campus at Mississippi State, and they did this to some areas as an experiment, and it was very successful. You have to manage the mindset of certain people that are used to seeing stuff just mowed all the time.
Yeah.
But there was some drainages on campus that they planted some plugs, and they also stuck willow cuttings in the ground, and they root. And it just became a corridor, you know, like a drainage corridor of plants, and it slows the water down. It lets a lot of the dirt particles fall out to the ground, so you're collecting free soil while you're doing it.
Yeah.
And so it helps clear the water by slowing it down. So, yeah, I wouldn't spend a lot of time clearing it. I would probably just plant it in that scenario, and then let those bad grasses get shaded out in time.
Probably. Gotcha. So what other kind of questions do you have on your list, Ed, that I don't have in front of me?
Let's see here. Okay. Somebody said the best way to incorporate wildflowers in an existing stand of grasses. We talked about that. I'm assuming he's talking about just native grasses, because that seemed to be the cool thing 10 years ago was, and there's nothing wrong with pure stands of native grasses. I love them.
It's beautiful to look
But yeah, you could probably just spray a little spot of glyphosate and make that, or just go in there with a shovel and turn some soil over, fling some seeds, or just stick a plug in there. But if you could just kill that one little bitty spot, you know, maybe a 1 square foot area, as soon as it pops up in the spring, and then stick a plug there, you can slowly get some wildflowers seeding in, and joining the party with the.
So the idea there is just creating a little bit of elbow room for them.
Yep.
So that they've got some room to grow.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm assuming that this is already an established, you know, what kind of grasses? Like, we're talking tall, waist high type grasses.
Yeah. Like little blue stem, big blue stem, yeah. Indian grass.
Yeah. So are you trying to plant a wildflower variety that tends to jump up and be a little taller in that situation? Or are you just going to plant some that are only like knee high?
Probably so. I mean, you're going to have both in there.
In the mix. Yeah.
Yeah. In time, you're going to probably start burning it. You may even do some light disking in there, things like that, to set back the tall grasses a little bit. Eventually, you know, like if this is on a slope or something, eventually the species that like to be taller are going to end up being further down the hill where there's more moisture. And the slower growing, shorter stuff is going to end up closer to the top of the hill. But yeah, like, for example, gray-headed coneflower is a good one that gets pretty tall. So, you could mix that in, off the top of my head, you know, that bergamot gets really tall.
Yeah.
Goldenrods get really tall. Purple coneflowers don't get super tall, but once they root in, you know, maybe around year 3 or 4, they do get a little bit taller. So I would just spread the love and get some diversity out there and let it sort itself out.
Gotcha. That's really cool what you say about, you know, you may plant it a certain way, but with time and nature doing its thing, they're going to end up migrating to the areas that they're happiest anyway.
Right.
If I'm paraphrasing that.
And that's the way it evolved. You know, there was shorter stuff on top of the hill and the taller stuff was at the bottom of the hill. I recently talked to a customer that is down in a river bottom, and it's just an amazing area for hunting. A really popular place for deer hunting in Mississippi. And it's a big old river bottom, and it had been farmed for years, and he was wanting it to come back, and he planted Chickasaw plum down in the big river bottom. Well, that's where big trees and stuff like to grow, and so it was just a lot to manage. So you do need to match the species to the site and consider doing that from the get-go. So if this is a grassland that's up on the top of a ridge or something like that, versus further down the hill, maybe a big valley or something like that, you're just going to need to put different species in different places. And one way is just to call me and tell me exactly where you are, and I can help you pick out what to order.
Rick Stewart asks, will it hurt them after establishing them, being the wildflowers and grasses, to then do a growing season burn?
Good question, Brick, from Drury. Well, wildflowers again evolved with summer burns going through them all the time from lightning strikes and such. And so they can handle it. Is it stressful for them? Yeah, but they usually bounce back. So oftentimes they've got a really strong root system that's got a lot of built up energy. Keep in mind, a lot of these plants have really deep roots. And so they can come back. I would not want to run a fire through a wildflower patch that I just planted.
That's what I was going to ask. So this is like year 2, 3, 4.
Right.
Before you'd start wanting to use a growing season burn.
But yeah, you can almost use it to your advantage sometimes. To set back some of the grasses and things that are in there. Even the native grasses are getting a little too thick. And you can burn them later in the summer and set them back and let the wildflowers try to, you know, form a bigger rosette while they've got sun. But it's tough.
Yeah.
Because also when you burn later in the summer, you're also kind of prepping the ground for cool season plants to pop up. And giving them more space. So it's hard to say, really.
Yeah.
But just keep in mind that for hundreds of thousands of years, we've had fires going through grasslands in the summertime, and they can handle it. You just don't want to do it. You probably don't want to do it in the first year.
I think something that would be really important for folks to start doing is keeping a log on their property of what they're doing, what they planted and where and when, because man, people ask themselves so many questions about what should I do here and all this. And the thing is they might have been doing one process that counteracts another one and they don't realize it.
Exactly.
And so if you take notes and you can talk to your extension agent or you can ask Dudley, but you have this history of what's happened on the property, it's a whole lot easier for you to self-diagnose and answer your question, but also to put the question in the hands of the experts.
Right. It's been a while, and I don't know if they're still doing this, but before COVID, the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Research Center, excuse me, in Texas, has been doing an ongoing experiment where they've been burning just a checkerboard pattern. They'll burn once in June, once in July, once in August, and doing different types of disturbances to see what comes back.
How big are these checkerboards?
I don't know.
Okay.
But large enough, you know, they're being scientific about it. So yeah, they've got replications and all that good stuff.
That's cool.
But that would be a good project to do around here. In fact, we've got that area behind the office we've been wanting to play with. But I encourage folks to do the same. You know, you could even have deals where, you know, you spray one area with glyphosate in February, you spray another in March, you know, different types of herbicides used for different types of habitats and see what comes back, have different burn intervals, things like that. And it may be different. You know, you go 50 miles down the road or you go to a different soil type and you may get a different reaction.
Gotcha. Okay. So if you are raising bees or you have a neighbor who's raising bees, are there certain varieties of wildflowers or certain practices with how you manage your wildflowers that'll be helpful or hurtful to the bees?
Well, bees are pretty opportunistic. And so honeybees are actually not from here. So they're from like Europe, the Mediterranean. So we brought them over here. They're actually not native.
I learned something new today.
Honeybees, they will go to things like clovers that we used to not have here. So they've got that going. But they also are attracted to a lot of our native wildflowers and trees that make flowers as well. So they're kind of lucky from that standpoint that they can survive off of our stuff or the non-native stuff around here. But yeah, I mean, you're not going to attract them by having a yard that you mow every week, but you're going to attract them by having everything except that. Gotcha. So yeah, you can have little wildflower patches. You might can have a little, you know, a little clover patch that you're already growing for your deer and turkeys anyway. And there's some of the best honey I've ever had. One of our customers brought to us, and he said it was on privet.
Really?
I can't believe I just admitted that. But anyway,
yeah.
So bees can, they can eat a lot of stuff.
What you're saying is there's not, you can do things that help, but the biggest thing that you can do to help is just not, just cut your pasture.
Yeah.
Mow
constantly mowing everything. And having a pine plantation everywhere is not going to be good for your honeybees.
Biodiversity.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things that my wife and I did, we grew some pumpkins a few years ago. Just jam up. We ended up with like 20,000 pumpkins. It was ridiculous.
And but the bees help pollinate them.
The bees help pollinate them. But one of the things that we did is we planted some flowers ahead of time to get bees in the area.
That's a great idea.
And the other thing is the way that, but anything like pumpkins or gourds and things of that nature, the way that they were designed and have evolved is that, that the male flowers come out first.
Yeah.
And they get the bees on a foraging pattern for a few weeks, maybe 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then the female flowers come out. And when I learned that, that blew my mind.
Yeah.
About,
and now that, you know, we've got people spraying in neighborhoods and things like that, we don't have as many insects pollinating our squash and stuff in the backyard. So a lot of us have gotten to where we go pull one of those male flowers off the vine.
Get a Q-tip and do that whole number.
And just wipe it on all the female flowers.
So what I was trying to say is use wildflowers.
To attract the
bees.
Absolutely.
That's something that we did, and it was effective. It was ridiculous, the number of pumpkins that we ended up with. So anyway.
Fun.
Yeah. Do you have any other questions or anything on your heart, Dudley?
Well, I'll always enjoy discussing anything about plants and trees and dirt. But really the big takeaway here, and I think a lot of us are learning this and we're just sponges about it, but how important the grassland wildflower type ecosystem is, whether you're a deer hunter or a backyard birder, we're all realizing how important it is and how we need to manage to have at least some of this habitat type, whether it's in our backyard, on our back 40, on our public lands, on our private lands, everywhere, at our office, at our front yard, and try to lead by example.
Yeah, and it really also seems like a thing that anybody can do and a really good thing to do with your kids.
Yeah.
To just put out some flowers. You know, it is a spiritual experience to watch something grow.
It really is.
It is. There's something that nurtures something deep inside of you when you get to be a part of watching something grow.
Absolutely.
And so,
seeing stuff using it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's awesome.
This is not a sales pitch.
No, it's not. I mean, it's something that you should just do.
I'm encouraging
it's good
people
for
to
you.
Do it.
It's good
it's
for
fun.
You.
It's fun.
Absolutely.
It's rewarding.
All right. Well, I think we've answered just about all the questions that we have on the list, or at least those that we have time for today. Guys, keep sending in your questions. This is fun, and this is something that keeps Dudley on his toes and keeps him sharp.
I'm always looking forward to more questions. We can't talk about wildflowers every week, even though I kind of want to. Maybe we can get into some more tree stuff or more hunting-related stuff.
Yeah, tree stuff, hunting-related stuff. We're going to kind of keep conversations of food plots and a lot of those sorts of things really on the Tuesday or the Monday podcast now.
Right.
But these things specifically, I mean, especially as we get into the fall and get into when it's the best time of the year to put stuff in the ground, we're definitely going to have a lot more Ask Dudleys out there coming down the pipe. So as long as y'all keep listening, we'll keep putting them out and they'll keep us having a job.
Yeah. Hopefully they'll let us come back.
That's right. All right. Well, I guess how does Bob say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.